Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from the Best American Short Stories from the year 2011, edited by Geraldine Brooks. To the Measures Fall by Richard Powers. First read through. You are biking through the Cotswolds when you come across the thing. Spring of 63. 21 years old in your junior year abroad at the University of York, after a spring term green with Chaucer, Milton, Byron, and Swinburne. Remember Swinburne? Year one of a life newly devoted to words. Your recent change, of course, has crushed your father. He long hoped you would follow through on that Kennedy-inspired dream of community service. You, who might have become a first-rate social worker. You, who might have done good things for the species, or at least for the old neighborhood. But life will be books for you from here on. Nothing has ever felt more preordained. Term's out, and it's time to see every square mile of this island. Bicycle clips, a blue guide, a transistor radio, and skin-hugging rain. Villages slip past on valley roads as twisty as the clauses in Henry James. The book turns up in a junk shop in an old Saxon market town whose name you will remember as almost certainly having an M in it. Among the rusted baby buggies and ancient radios you find old cooking magazines, books on fly tying and photography, late 50s spy novels with cardboard covers worn as soft as felt. The thing pops out at you, To the Measures Fall by someone named Elton Wentworth. There's nothing else like it in the shop. It's a fat tome with rough-cut pages in a deluxe tooled binding. The dust jacket has disappeared, but the front matter suggests that you know all about Mr. Wentworth already. Born in 1888, the author of 12 previous books and the winner of awards too numerous to mention. The first line reads, A freak snow hit late that year, 2 weeks after the sand martins returned to the gravel pits near the South Downs. The next few paragraphs stretch out a hard-pressed town, Wotton-on-Wold, much like the one you are in, with an M in it. On page 3, the author reveals the date, 1913. On the last page, a village search party finds the body of a young amputee captain who served at the Somme, lying in the bottom of said gravel pits. Only 7 years have passed, but the lilting opening cadences have darkened into fragments from another world. The book seems to be a sweeping portrait of rural England before and after the First World War. You check the title page, copyright 1948. Aside from two bold exclamation points at the end of chapter 1, the pages are unblemished, perhaps unread. Penciled into the upper right hand of the inside front is a price, 10/6D. Exorbitant. You draw £7 a week for student expenses. A three-course Chinese dinner on Station Road costs 4 shillings, and lunch in the canteen is half that. A 12-inch LP runs only £1, and even a 2-minute call to the States is cheaper than Mr. Wentworth's book. Half a guinea for a used novel you've never heard of? Robbery. But something about that opening is too strange for you to resist. Besides, you've just devoted your life to literature. You graze the start of Chapter 2, in which Trevor, a spindly farmer's son with Addison's disease, baffles his parents by insisting on going to university. You need to know how this beginning can reach so macabre an end. This shop's owner is a beaked old man with a gray hairline like a cowl slipping off his head. It's humiliating to bargain with him, but you're desperate. How much do you offer the junk store owner for his used book? You are, by the way, female. Lots of folks think you shouldn't be out biking alone, even in the Cotswolds. See pages 214 to 223 of Mr. Wentworth's epic. How much would you have offered for the book had you been male? You buy the book, lug it around on the rest of the bike tour, drag it back up north with you, but somehow fail to read it. When summer ends, and with it your English idol, you're shocked to discover how many essential novels you've bought and haven't gotten around to reading. Now the problem is packing them all into a suitcase that's lighter than 44 pounds. You can mail them to the States, but they'd cost more to ship than you spent to buy them. You reserve the time-honored system of 3 piles. 1. Keep for all time. 2. Suspend in purgatory. 3. Cast forever into the outer darkness.
by the evening before the homeward flight, To the Measure's Fall is stuck stubbornly in purgatory, along with Wheelock's What is Poetry, James Purdy's Malcolm, The Bull from the Sea by Mary Renault, John Brain's bestseller Life at the Top, and Updike's The Centaur, which has got mixed reviews. Life at the Top might be tricky to get hold of in the States. Who knows how long Updike will be read? Malcolm, on the other hand, is already on every undergraduate syllabus in the country. Renault, Guilty Pleasure, is the one you'd really love to have in your carry-on. The Further Adventures of Theseus and Hippolyta, with sun-drenched temples, earthquakes, and human-god miscegenation, how better to fill 8 hours of captive reading? But your bag will hold only 4 more volumes. Choose which 2 books get dumped forever. Wentworth makes the cut, if only as a souvenir of that magical cycling tour. Weirdly, browsing through the bookshop in the Oceanic Terminal at Heathrow, you notice a reprint of one of his earlier novels about coal miners in Wales. It's a penguin with that orange spine that's synonymous with great books. There's a jacket blurb from Winston Churchill calling Wentworth this island's Balzac, our much-revered, much-imitated national asset, and another from Dame Edith Sitwell, DBE, calling him England's most distinguished living author of the novel of community. National asset makes Wentworth sound like a hulking stone country house given away by pauperized aristocrats for tax deductions, and most distinguished feels a bit dated against a backdrop of mods, rockers, the angry young men, and beyond the fringe. Still, 2 immortal literary lions have praised this man to the skies. What an incredible deal, getting that first edition for 8 shillings. Clearly the balding junk shop owner didn't know what he was selling. Far out over the Atlantic as you approach Greenland, a twinge of conscience hits you. What good is all the cultivation in the world if you use it to cheat ignorant people? How much should you have paid the shopkeeper? Exceed his proposed price, if necessary. Back in the States, you look up Elton Wentworth. He isn't England's most distinguished living anything. He died right around the time that you realize you'd sooner sell cigarettes from a shoulder tray than go into social work. In addition to sheep in the Cotswolds and coal in Wales, he did Lincolnshire fishermen and 3 generations of Brummy factory workers. He wasn't England's Balzac. He was a James Michener of the Midlands. You read the first 100 pages of To the Measure's Fall, hacking your way through thickets of dialect. The prose can be brutally beautiful, but the semester starts, you fall in love, get deflowered, watch Kennedy die and the Beatles invade, get high to listen to Coltrane, and discover Heller, Ellison, Ferlinghetti, and Bellow, writing that flows across the page in huge, bright swaths that you didn't know English could permit. So the First World War was a bad scene. Aren't we over that yet? And what was Wentworth doing bringing out a book wrapped in Edwardian nostalgia 3 years after Dachau? You graduate in the spring and pack up your worldly possessions again, just as the USS Maddox fires on 3 patrol boats in the Gulf of Tonkin, letting Johnson widen a war in a country that until recently was as fictional to you as Wentworth's South Downs. Does the book go to Goodwill, the Salvation Army, or the 25-cent pile at your graduation lawn sale? You survive 2 years of graduate classes, the general comprehensive test, flubbing the question on Tobias Smollett, marriage to a Faulkner guy, and a grueling 400-book special field exam on the electric complex in post-war American prose, a subject that you begin to hate long before your committee can lob the first question. All the while, there's Biafra, Black Power, the levitation of the Pentagon, My Lai, back-to-back assassinations, the siege of Chicago, street warfare, and city centers burning in an annual summer ritual. Drugs are everywhere, making people see God or murder their families. Books go surreal, psychedelic, and sometimes you wonder whether they're causing the mayhem or just profiting from it. The dissertation, your baggy monster, becomes a 4-year excuse to read everything except those writers you threaten to write about. On a hot June Thursday, early in the new decade, right around the time when 5 men break into the DNC headquarters in D.C., you find yourself patrolling your own shelves like a hopeful bidder at an estate sale. It's a shock to come across that deluxe binding which you distinctly remember throwing out a long time ago. The Cotswolds' Cruel Joke, Elgarian Imperial Residue. You take it down and browse. You stop to fix dinner for your husband, who, an invalid of high modernism, cannot fix it for himself. But you're back at Wentworth until 4 a.m. when you end up at the bottom of the South Downs gravel pit, 1920, your throat feeling as if you've been taking swabs at it with a pipe cleaner. You don't know what hurts more, the swirling moral turbulence of the book or the belated discovery that everything you thought about it was wrong. You missed it all, register, mood, irony, ambiguity, subtleties of characterization, narrative arc, even basic plot points. You can't read. It's like finding out at 30 that you're adopted. You're not yet sure that it's great literature, but the thing took you underwater and held you there for the better part of 13 hours, and 2 days later you're still winded. Its single history-slapped village is a whole world, whose heft and weight and strange sinuous tangle of syntax stands for nothing but itself. Its portraits, particularly that of Sarah, the mother of doomed Captain Trevor, and the furtive wife of idealism-scarred Francis Beck, seem so clearly ripped from microscopic observation that it's cheating to call them fiction. This story is not your life. It's not your time or place. It's just a scrap of torn diary floating up from a scorched past. What does the thing want from you? Give the book a final grade. Fail, low pass, pass. Pass with honors, highest distinction. You make your husband read it. You do the Lysistrata thing until he does. This is a mistake, as he reads it way too fast. Very well done, he reports, wanting his sugar cube. Skillful, first-rate social realism. Why haven't more people written about this guy? It isn't skillful. It isn't social realism. You read it again, taking a week this time. Now the book gets more troubling, more weirdly allegorical. You can't put your finger on what bothers you. Something to do with hoping against your better judgment. You lie awake on a hot August night wondering how a thing might be good and real and true for a while, then made irrelevant or worse by later events. You've got very close with your thesis advisor. In fact, if you remember right, you're sleeping with him. The two of you are in an actual bed somewhere in the dark, a luxury you can no longer imagine how you managed. Maybe it's an OPEC oil crisis thing. Turn off the lights when not in use. The two of you are playing that old favorite. Which classic would you never dare admit to anyone but your lover in the dark that you haven't read? You offer Silas Lapham, and he ups the ante to Billy Budd, and you try to trump with The Sound and the Fury, which he blows out of the water with Huck Finn. You ask him if he's ever read any Wentworth. He just snickers, thinking it another game. You obsess about the thing. You read all the criticism. Most of it damns itself with due diligence. Trevor Beck and Erickson's theory of psychosocial development. Wool, surplus value, and class unrest in Wentworth's Wotton on Wold. No article has an insight strong enough to explain why you should be reading it rather than the book again. You learn all kinds of things about Elton Wentworth, some of which you wish you hadn't. Blacklisted for pacifist activity under the Defense of Realm Act. Went to Russia between the wars and came back extolling the enlightened social state. Right up until Munich, a prominent appeaser. But come September 1939, he turned British superpatriot and personal propagandizer for Churchill, which helped explain the latter's jacket blurb. After the war, he fought decolonization tooth and nail in a series of interviews with dozens of natives on three continents who all declared the British Empire the best thing ever to happen to its colonial subjects. At the age of 81, he was jailed for 3 months for participating in violent demonstrations against nuclear weapons. In short, the author of that autonomous, ungrudging, unjudging book with no villains and fewer heroes, in which every moral position is plausible but flawed, was himself a hopeless, card-carrying, repeat-offending true believer. Grade Elton Wentworth's public performance. Separate marks for form, style, and intent. In one of the Wentworth biographies, you come across a photograph of a note to Wentworth from Sir Winston himself. The letter's signature vaguely resembles the inked scrawl that you've never paid attention to on the inside front cover of your copy, underneath the penciled price that now fills you with shame. The signature in the reproduced note reads, Winnie. The drooping, obscured squiggle in your copy looks more like Hump Hump Clunlutch. You are insane, of course. hallucinating from over-research. There is no way on any likely earth that a book belonging to one of the century's most famous personages could end up in a junk shop in the Cotswolds. Winston Churchill, Nobel laureate in literature, wasn't about to write his name in his bloody books. If found, please return to the House of Commons, London. You try to erase the penciled price for a better look, but you succeed only in smearing the signature. You look up every occurrence of Churchill's signature on record in the university's library. There is a similarity. The book gives you nothing else to go on except the two bold exclamation points at the end of the first chapter. The one on the right seems distinctly Churchillian. You'd take the book to an appraiser, but you get paranoid. This is exactly the kind of scenario in which the naive get bilked. On your next trip to the city, you show it to an antiquarian whom you've bought from many times. He listens to your theory with a tight, embarrassed smile. He says that even if you did get the signature certified, which could cost considerable blood, toil, tears, and sweat, the simple signature without any further marginalia might not greatly increase the book's value. Given the dicey nature of the scribble, you may not want to pay for the appraisal. But he's willing to give you $50 for the copy for a good customer. $50 could buy 2 years of used novels. Deal or no deal? You keep the copy for reasons that reason doesn't understand, but 2.5 months later you wipe out on literature altogether. You're out of time in the graduate program and still no dis. Your husband says no kids until you finish, but you can't finish. The thesis isn't even embarrassing. Psychoanalytic readings reek of 6 years ago, and this new post-structural stuff gives you hives. You crash and burn. The house goes to pot. You glue yourself to the Watergate hearings for weeks. The whole mad circus is like a Dickens serial saga. You talk to the screen, cheering and hissing. You even develop a little thing for Sam Irvin. You get a job adjuncting at a nearby college, intros and surveys, but drumming up enthusiasm for Wharton and Cather is murder. These days it's all Pynchon and Bartlemy, Coover and Gaddis and Gass. The cannon goes up in smoke. You realize belatedly that you're a co-opted false consciousness servant of empire, a capo of privileged heteronormative white paternalism, but it's too late to retool. Around the fall of Saigon, plagued by those films of people on the embassy rooftop clutching the runners of escaping helicopters, you bail out into law school. It's the only practical choice. And doesn't law at bottom involve the same act of eternal verbal negotiation as reading? The marriage breaks up under the pressure of 1L. Your only recreational reading for the next 2 years is the Congressional Record. You get a good job with a decent boutique firm specializing in intellectual property. None of your dozens of bright, well-read colleagues have ever heard of Watton on Wold. You marry again, this time for real, to a big police procedural fan in corporate litigation. At the last possible moment, you have kids, 3 of them, 1 reader and 2 watchers who get their ABCs from purple and green televised puppets. Nothing will ever light up the cortex faster than cathode rays. Yet, with your reader daughter, the whole awful gut-wrenching seduction happens all over again. Urban ducklings, wild things, purple crayons, it doesn't matter. Your daughter, glaze-eyed and body-snatched, chants, "Read, Mommy, read," like she's off in Neverland already, even before the first verb. And you, fallen Wendy, eviscerated by the eternal recurrence of it all, hear Peter snarl at you for growing guilty and big and old, while something inside you cries, "Woman, woman, let go of me." A few years pass, and still your daughter is reading furiously. You'll lose her eventually to the rising flood of film, the swelling archive of video that offers whole new republics of visual democracy. Who knows how long the page will hold her attention? Do you rush her into the good stuff while you can? Maybe if you time things right, the whole crumbling Edwardian stage set of Watton on Wold will strike her as some kind of hyper-Narnia. When should you push Wentworth on Jane? 1. Never too early. 2. Never too late. 3. Never gonna happen. Your children become the heroes of their own plots, time-worn narratives, and unrecognizable new bindings. The 80s pass while your energies are spent elsewhere, on building up the college tuition war chest, on making partner, on helping companies copyright common English words. You still read for pleasure, all kinds of things. The hunger remains, but, as with sex, the costumes must grow ever more elaborate to produce the same transport. You're caught somewhere between reading for recognition and reading for estrangement. Mostly what you read are reviews. Too few hours left to do more than scan the books that you know you'd love. At least you can read what the gatekeepers say about this fall's lineup, and often imagining a book from its synopsis beats what you do manage to slog through. The reviews accumulate faster than you can flip through them. What you really need is a thumbnail summary of the thumbnail summaries. A year or so after Grenada and Iran-Contra or some such thing, while blasting through last year's stack of unread literary weeklies prior to pitching them, you come across the fact that To the Measures Fall, long out of print, is being reissued in an annotated essential library edition, part of a general renaissance of Wentworth, who, the review laments, has been in a 20-year decline. The reviewer calls Measures the once-celebrated, now-forgotten British Magic Mountain. He claims that Wentworth's wartime Midlands still have as much to reveal as any of the marginalized regions of the earth. Can that possibly include Lesotho, Lebanon, the Punjab? The retrospective appreciation feels like one of those lifetime achievement awards that you get for having the courtesy to stay dead. The new cover for the Essential Library Edition is dazzling. It makes Wentworth look like the next Alice Walker. You're not sure what constitutes a decent interval between much-revered national asset and unfairly undervalued. For the reviewer, the revival proves the one universal truth about literary merit. Quality will surface in the run of time. The trick is to stop time at just the right moment. Who was Elton Wentworth exactly? Choose one. One, the currently most unjustly underrated author of his generation. Two, the formerly most justly overrated author of his generation. Three, the soon-to-be least unjustly re-rated author of his generation. New annotated editions flood the market. Does your boat go up? You break down and pay an appraiser 10 times what you would have 10 years ago to look at your copy. Churchill's marked-up volume, it turns out, went for £800 at Sotheby's, just as the new Wentworth Renaissance hit. Your copy belonged to a Cotswold sheep farmer named H.H. Cleanleach. The appraiser offers you $10 off his fee. The boys in information processing install a terminal in your office that fulfills your old dream, rapid access to abstracts of all the articles that you can no longer find time to read. In between researching briefs, you follow the boomlet in Wentworth Studies. The reader response people take him up, then those who study reputational revision. There's a minor heyday in swarming any author still in the state of pre-post-exhaustion just before the idea of single-author studies gives out. A modernist at New Mexico State proves that To the Measures Fall was really written around 1928, suppressed by Wentworth for 2 decades, then published, despite his objections, in a form he didn't want. A Barnard associate prof proves that half of the novel was the work of Wentworth's longtime mistress. A graduate student at Indiana proves that the book is riddled with historical error. Scholars of all ranks show how Wentworth was the product of 1,000 horrific cultural blindnesses and Eurocentric brutalities. Write a brief letter to no one about what you once thought the book might mean. The Berlin Wall falls and the evil empire falls with it. The Cold War ends and for a moment history does too. You stop reading anything that is more than 2 months old. You don't exactly remember the 90s. The Gulf, of course. Something about Somalia and Sarajevo. Smoke everywhere. Lots of colored ribbons tied around America's trees. The firm keeps dangling the promise of senior partnership, but it never quite happens. The 1993 feature film adaptation of To the Measures Fall stars Daniel Day-Lewis and Emma Thompson. There's an extended hallucinatory sequence depicting the suicidal slow walk at the Somme, filmed in Scotland, graphically matched to a torrid sex scene on the heath outside Wotton-on-Wold, filmed in a Hollywood sound studio. A tie-in paperback edition appears with a glossy movie still cover featuring the gorgeous leads. Rate the film. 1. Worth the price of a movie ticket. 2. Worth videotaping when it comes on TV. 3. Worth denouncing at a dinner party. 4. Worth a class action suit by readers everywhere. On your 55th birthday, the age at which the terminally ill Sarah Beck must identify her son's body at the foot of the South Downs gravel pit, you join a book group. The kids are grown, the career's on autopilot, the husband is off playing paintball, and it's time to read again. Books are back in more flavors than ever. Cool books, slick books, innovative remixes, massive doorstops, funny jeu d'esprit, weepy Uyghur Bildungsromans, caustic family sagas from Kazakhstan. Books in every market niche and biome. Avant, après, post, retro. Back, too, is a long-dead art of communal reading. Okay, maybe a few of your book group members are in it for the finger food, but you've forgotten what a pleasure it is to discuss out loud. Aimless talk about love and lust, responsibility, hope, and pain. Together over 2 years, you read the major national selections. Your fellow members bring their old secret freight out of deep storage. You take 9 months to work up to your request. You're unsure of your friends, unsure of your ability to reread, unsure of just what's in that treacherous book these days. You read it slowly this time, a chapter a night, over the course of weeks. This time, though, the book is no more than a grand, futile gesture of nevertheless in the face of human frailty. Francis Beck's refusal to believe that his wife is ill, a feckless cowardice that turns by insistence almost heroic. Alice Wright's paralyzing premonition, which she can't act upon without destroying the man who would destroy her. Trevor's premeditated signal to Alice, ready to launch itself from beyond the grave. Two club members report flinging the book across the room in a rage. Another demands her 3 days back. Accusations multiply. It's mawkish, it's cerebral, it's meandering, it's manipulative, it's cold and cunning and misanthropic, it's wrecked by redemption. How are we supposed to care about these characters? I just wanted them all to get a life. But a few people in the group don't know what hit them. One friend hated the first 50 pages but wanted 50 more after the end. The quietest man in the group comes back from Watton-on-Wold wrapped in brittle bewilderment at his own existence. It's a custom of the group, introduced by the male minority, to assign every book a letter grade. Yours gets a C+. What percentage of your pleasure has gone out of the book forever, fractions permitted? Overnight, the World Wide Web weaves tightly around you. A novelty at first, then invaluable, then life support, then heroin. It's a chance to recapture everything you've ever lost. College friends, out-of-print rarities, quotations that had vanished forever. Your online hours must come from somewhere, and it isn't from your TV viewing. You lose whole days on the roller coaster of real-time eBay auctions. Volumes of Wentworth go off at every price, from triple digits down to $1.99. You rescue a few to give to friends someday or whenever. It thrills you to discover a site where all the shameless recidivist Wentworth readers in the world gather to post their guilty pleasures. You subscribe to a feed. 6 months later, the community spirals into civil war as a thread between sock puppets and anonymous avatars goes up in flames. You watch the Amazon ratings for To the Measures Fall drop steadily from a high of 4.5 stars to a low somewhat below that of a defective wood chipper. The wisdom of crowds means to send Wentworth into a third and final eclipse. You consider logging in at comfort suites across the country, creating all kinds of personae to rescue the book for another generation of Wentworth readers whenever they dare to come out of hiding. How many aliases do you create to rate the book? 1. Just enough to boost the book back to its rightful rating. 2. Sarah Beck would never create an alias. Then the new century. Terror and sci-fi become life's dominant genres. War turns perpetual. The last print newspapers head toward extinction. More words get posted in 5 years than were published in all previous history. Global warming threatens to flood coasts inhabited by 500 million people. Most of the planet suffers from drought or tainted water. Name the book that best captures life as now lived. 2 months before you plan to retire, you learn that you have a massive hilar tumor nestled up in the stem of your lungs where nothing can reach it. It's right where Sarah Beck's is, if you're imagining correctly. Your daughter, the reader, brings you the book to keep you company in a state-of-the-art cancer center in your bed next to a window that looks out onto a brick wall 10 feet across a cement courtyard. You read it again. Not the whole book, of course. You couldn't possibly read a whole anything. But you manage a few pages, searching for a creature that recedes in front of your gaze. This time the book is about the shifting delusion of shared need, our imprisonment in a medium as traceless as air. It's about a girl who knew nothing at all, taking a bike ride through the Cotswolds one ridiculous spring, mistaking books for life and those roiling hills of metaphor for truth. It's about a little flash glimpse for half a paragraph at the bottom of a left-hand page that fills you with something almost like knowing. A freak snow hits late that year. You lie in bed an hour from your next morphine dose, your swollen index finger marking a secret place in the spine-cracked volume, the passage that predicted your life. For a moment you are lucid and equal to any story. Score the world on a scale from 1 to 10. Say what you'd like to see happen in the sequel. And that story was To the Measures Fall by Richard Powers from the Best American Short Stories from the year 2011, edited by Geraldine Brooks. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from Great Short Stories of the World, edited by Lois Hill. The Phonograph and the Graft by O. Henry. I looked in at the engine room of the Bloomfield Cater Manufacturing Company Limited, for the engineer was Kirksey, and there was a golden half-hour between the time he shut down steam and washed up that I coveted. For Kirksey was an improvisator. He told stories from the inside outward, finally leaving his spoken words and his theme to adjust themselves as best they might. I found Kirksey resting, with his pipe lighted, smut-faced and blue-overalled. "'Tis a fair afternoon, I said, but bids to be colder. "'Did I ever tell you,' began Kirksey honorably, "'about the time Henry Horsecollar and me took a phonograph to South America, "'and I felt ashamed of my subterfuge "'and dropped into the wooden chair he kicked toward me. "'Henry was a quarter-breed quarterback Cherokee, "'educated east in the idioms of football, "'and west in contraband whiskey, "'and a gentleman same as you or me.' He was easy and romping in his ways, a man about 6 foot, with a kind of rubber-tire movement. Yes, he was a little man about 5'5" or 5'11". He was what you would call a medium-tall man of average smallness. Henry had quit college once, and the Muskegee jail 3 times, once for introducing and twice for selling whiskey in the territories. Henry Horsecollar never let any cigar stores come up and stand behind him. He didn't belong to that tribe of Indians. Henry and me met at Texarkana and figured out this phonograph scheme. He had $360, which came to him out of a land allotment in the reservation. I had run down from Little Rock on account of a distressful scene I had witnessed on the street there. A man stood on a box and passed around some gold watches, screw case, stem winders, Elgin movement, very elegant. $20 they cost you over the counter. At $3 the crowd fought for the tickers. The man happened to find a valise full of them handy, and he passed them out like putting hot biscuits on a plate. The backs were hard to unscrew, but the crowd put its ear to the case, and they ticked mollifyingly and agreeable. 3 of those watches were genuine tickers, but the rest, they were only kickers. Hey, why empty cases with one of them horny black bugs that fly around electric lights in 'em? Them bugs kick off minutes and seconds, industrious and beautiful. The man I was speaking of cleaned up $288 and went away, because he knew that when it came time to wind watches in Little Rock, an entomologist would be needed, and he wasn't one. So, as I say, Henry had $360, and I had $288. The phonograph idea was Henry's, but I took to it freely, being fond of machinery of all kinds. The Latin races, says Henry, explaining easy in his idioms he learned at college, are peculiarly adapted to be victims of the phonograph. They possess the artistic temperament. They yearn for music and color and gaiety. They give up wampum to the hand-organ man or the four-legged chicken when they're months behind with the grocery and the breadfruit tree. Then, says I, we'll export canned music to the Latins, but I'm mindful of Mr. Julius Caesar's account of them when he says, Omnia Gallia in tres parts divisa est, which is the same as to say we will need all of our gall in devising means to tree them parties. I hated to make a show of education, but I was disinclined to be overdone in syntax by a mere Indian, to whom we owe nothing except the land on which the United States is situated. We bought a fine phonograph in Texarkana, one of the best make, and half a trunk full of records. We packed up and took the T&P for New Orleans. From that celebrated center of molasses and disfranchised coon songs, we took a steamer for, yes, I think it was South America or Mexico. I am full of inability to divulge the location of it. 'Tis on the rural delivery route. 'Tis colored yellow on the map and branded with the literature of cigar boxes. We landed on a smiling coast at a town they denounced by the name, as near as I can recollect, of Sorto Kangaroo. 'Twas a palatable enough place to look at. The houses were clean and white, sticking about among the scenery like hard-boiled eggs served with lettuce. There was a block of skyscraper mountains in the suburbs, and they kept pretty quiet, like they was laying one finger on their lips and watching the town. And the sea was remarking shh on the beach, and now and then a ripe coconut would fall kerplip in the sand, and that was all there was doing. Yes, I judged that town was considerably on the quiet. I judged that, after Gabriel quits blowing his horn and the car starts, with Philadelphia swinging to the last strap and Pine Gully, Arkansas, hanging onto the hind rail, Sorto Kangaroo will wake up and ask if anybody spoke. The captain went ashore with us and offered to conduct what he seemed to like to call the obsequies. He introduced Henry and me to the United States Consul and a roan man, the head of the Department of Mercenary and Licentious Dispositions, the way it read upon his sign. "I touch here again a week from today," says the captain. "By that time," we told him, "we'll be amassing wealth in the interior towns with our galvanized prima donna and correct imitations of Sousa's band excavating a march from a tin mine." "Ye'll not," says the captain. "Ye'll be hypnotized. Any gentleman in the audience who kindly steps upon the stage and looks this country in the eye will be converted to the hypothesis that he's but a fly in the Elgin Creamery. You'll be standing knee-deep in the surf waiting for me, and your machine for making hamburger steak out of the hitherto respected art of music will be playing 'There's No Place Like Home.'" Henry scanned a 20 off his roll and received from the Bureau of Mercenary Dispositions a paper bearing a red seal and a dialect story and no change. Then we got the consul full of red wine and struck him for a horoscope. He was a thin, youngish kind of man, I should say past 50, sort of French-Irish in his affections, and puffed up with disconsolation. Yes, he was a flattened kind of man, in whom drink lay stagnant, inclined to corpulence and misery. Yes, I think he was a kind of Dutchman, being very sad and genial in his ways. "The marvelous invention," he says, "entitled the phonograph, has never before invaded these shores. The people have never heard it. They would not believe it if they should. Simple-hearted children of nature, progress has never condemned them to accept the work of a can-opener as an overture, and ragtime might incite them to a bloody revolution. But you can try the experiment. The best chance you have is that the populace may not wake up when you play. There's two ways, says the council, they may take it. They may become inebriated with attention, like an Atlanta colonel listening to Marching Through Georgia, or they will get excited and transpose the key of the music with an axe and yourselves into a dungeon. In the latter case," says the consul, "I'll do my duty by cabling to the State Department, and I'll wrap the stars and stripes around you when you come to be shot, and threaten them with the vengeance of the greatest gold export and financial reserve nation on earth. The flag is full of bullet holes now," says the consul, "made in that way. Twice before," says the consul, "I've cabled our government for a couple of gunboats to protect American citizens. The first time the department sent me a pair of gum boots. The other time was when a man named Pease was going to be executed here. They referred that appeal to the Secretary of Agriculture. Let us now disturb the signor behind the bar for a subsequence of the red wine." Thus soliloquized the consul of Sorto Kangaroo to me and Henry Horsecollar. But notwithstanding, we hired a room that afternoon in the Calle de Los Angeles, the main street that runs along the shore, and put our trunks there. 'Twas a good-sized room, dark and cheerful, but small. 'Twas on a various street, diversified by houses and conservatory plants. The peasantry of the city passed to and fro on the fine pasturage between the sidewalks. 'Twas for the world like an opera chorus when the Royal Kafluzlum is about to enter. We were rubbing the dust off the machine and getting fixed to start business the next day when a big, fine-looking white man in white clothes stopped at the door and looked in. We extended the invitations, and he walked inside and sized us up. He was chewing a long cigar and wrinkling his eyes, meditative, like a girl trying to decide which dress to wear to the party. "New York," he says to me finally. "Originally and from time to time," I says. "Hasn't it rubbed off yet?" "It's simple," says he, "when you know how. It's the fit of the vest. They don't cut vests right anywhere else. Coats, maybe, but not vests." The white man looks at Henry horse collar and hesitates. "Injun," says Henry, "tame Injun." "Mellinger," says the man, "Homer P. Mellinger. Boys, you're confiscated. You're babes in the wood without a chaperone or referee, and it's my duty to start you going. I'll knock out the props and launch you proper in the pellucid waters of Sore Toe Kangaroo. You'll have to be christened, and if you'll come with me, I'll break a bottle of wine across your bows, according to Hoyle." Well, for 2 days, Homer P. Mellinger did the honors. The man cut ice in Sore Toe Kangaroo. He was it. He was a royal kafloozum. If me and Henry was babes in the woods, he was a robin redbreast from the topmost bough. Him and me and Henry Horsecollar locked arms and toted that phonograph around and had wassail and diversions. Everywhere we found doors open, we went in and set the machine going, and Mellinger called upon the people to observe the artful music and his lifelong friends, the two señores Americanos. The opera chorus was agitated with esteem and followed us from house to house. There was vino tinto and vino blanco to drink with every tune. The aborigines had acquirements of a pleasant thing in the way of drinks that gums itself to the recollection. They chop off the end of a green coconut and pour in on the liquor of it French brandy and gin. We had them and other things. Mine and Henry's money was counterfeit. Everything was on Homer P. Mellinger. That man could find rolls of bills in his clothes where Herman the Wizard couldn't have conjured out an omelet. He could have founded universities and had enough left to buy the colored vote of his country. Henry and me wondered what his graft was. One evening he told us. "Boys," says he, "I've deceived you. Instead of a painted butterfly, I'm the hardest worked man in this country. 10 years ago I landed on its shores, and 2 years ago on the point of its jaw. Yes, I reckon I can get the decision over this ginger cake commonwealth at the end of any round I choose. I'll confide in you because you are my countrymen and guests, even if you have committed an assault upon my adopted shores with the worst system of noises ever set to music. My job is private secretary to the president of this republic, and my duties are running it. I'm not headlined in the bills, but I'm the mustard in the salad dressing. There isn't a law goes before Congress, there isn't a concession granted, there isn't an import duty levied, but what H.P. Mellinger, he cooks and seasons it. In the front office I fill the president's inkstand and search visiting statesmen for dynamite. In the back room I dictate the policy of the government. You'd never guess how I got the pull. It's the only graft of its kind in the world. I'll put you wise. You remember the top liner in the old copybooks? Honesty is the best policy. That's it. I'm the only honest man in this republic. The government knows it, the people know it, the boodlers know it, the foreign investors know it. I make the government keep its faith. If a man is promised a job, he gets it. If outside capital buys a concession, they get the goods. I run a monopoly of square dealing here. There's no competition. If Colonel Diogenes were to flash his lantern in this precinct, he'd have my address inside of 2 minutes. There isn't big money in it, but it's a sure thing and lets a man sleep of nights. This Homer P. Mellinger made oration to me and Henry Horsecollar in Sore Toe Kangaroo, and later he divested himself of this remark. "Boys, I'm to hold a soiree this evening with a gang of leading citizens, and I want your assistance. You bring the musical corn sheller and give the affair the outside appearance of a function. There's important business on hand, but it mustn't show. I can talk to you people. I've been pained for years on account of not having anybody to blow off and brag to. I get homesick sometimes, and I'd swap the entire perquisites of office for just 1 hour to have a stein and a caviar sandwich somewhere on 34th Street and stand and watch the streetcars go by and smell the peanut roaster at old Giuseppe's fruit stand. Yes, said I, there's fine caviar at Billy Renfro's Cafe, corner of 34th and... God knows it, interrupts Mellinger, and if you've told me you knew Billy Renfro, I'd have invented tons of way of making you happy. Billy was my sidekicker in New York. That is a man who never knew what crooked was. Here I am working honesty for a graft, but that man loses money on it. Carambos! I get sick at times of this country. Everything's rotten. From the executive down to the coffee pickers, they're plotting to down each other and skin their friends. If a mule driver takes off his hat to an official, that man figures it out that he's a popular idol and sets his pegs to stir up a revolution and upset the administration. It's one of my little chores as private secretary to smell out these revolutions and affix the kibosh before they break out and scratch the paint off the government property. That's why I'm down here now in this mildewed coast town. The governor of the district and his crew are plotting to uprise. I've got every one of their names, and they're invited to listen to the phonograph tonight, compliments of HPM. That's the way I'll get them in a bunch, and things are on the program to happen to them. We three were sitting at table in the cantina of the Purified Saints. Mellinger poured out wine and was looking some worried. I was thinking. They're a sharp crowd, he says, kind of fretful. They're capitalized by a foreign syndicate after rubber, and they're loaded to the muzzle for bribing. I'm sick, goes on Mellinger, of comic opera. I want to smell East River and wear suspenders again. At times I feel like throwing up my job, but I'm damn fool enough to be sort of proud of it. There's Mellinger, they say here. Por Dios, you can't touch him with a million. I'd like to take that record back and show it to Billy Renfro some day, and that tightens my grip whenever I see a fat thing that I could corral just by winking one eye and losing my graft. Bye. They can't monkey with me. They know it. What money I get, I make honest and spend it. Some day I'll make a pile and go back and eat caviar with Billy. Tonight I'll show you how to handle a bunch of corruptionists. I'll show them what Mellinger, private secretary, means when you spell it with the cotton and tissue paper off. Mellinger appears shaky and breaks his glass against the neck of the bottle. I says to myself, white man, if I'm not mistaken, there's been a bait laid out where the tail of your eye could see it. That night, according to arrangements, me and Henry took the phonograph to a room in an adobe house in a dirty side street where the grass was knee-high. 'Twas a long room lighted with smoky oil lamps. There was plenty of chairs and a table at the back end. We set the phonograph on the table. Mellinger was there, walking up and down disturbed in his predicaments. He chewed cigars and spat 'em out, and he bit the thumbnail of his left hand. By and by the invitations to the musical came sliding in by pairs and threes and spade flushes. Their color was of a diversity running from a 3 days smoked meerschaum to a patent leather polish. They were as polite as wax, being devastated with enjoyments to give Signor Mellinger the good evenings. I understood their Spanish talk. I ran a pumping engine 2 years in a Mexican silver mine and had it pat, but I never let on. Maybe 50 of 'em had come and was seated when in slid the King Bee, the governor of the district. Mellinger met him at the door and escorted him to the grandstand. When I saw that Latin man, I knew that Mellinger, private secretary, had all the dances on his card taken. That was a big, squashy man, the color of a rubber overshoe, and he had an eye like a head waiter's. Mellinger explained, fluent in the Castilian idioms, that his soul was disconcerted with joy at introducing to his respected friends America's greatest invention, the wonder of the age. Henry got the cue and run on an elegant brass band record, and the festivities became initiated. The governor man had a bit of English under his hat, and when the music was choked off, he says, "Very fine. Gracias. The American gentleman. The so splendid music as to play." The table was a long one, and Henry and me sat at the end of it next to the wall. The governor sat at the other end. Homer P. Mellinger stood at the side of it. I was just wondering how Mellinger was going to handle his crowd when the home talent suddenly opened the services. That governor man was suitable for uprisings and policies. I judge he was a ready kind of man who took his own time. Yes, he was full of attentions and immediateness. He leaned his hands on the table and imposed his face toward the secretary man. "Do the American señores understand Spanish?" he asks in his native accents. "They do not," says Mellinger. "Then listen," goes on the Latin man prompt. "The musics are of sufficient prettiness, but not of a necessity. Let us speak of business. I well know why we are here, since I observe my compatriots. You had a whisper yesterday, Signor Mellinger, of our proposals. Tonight we will speak out. We know that you stand in the president's favor, and we know your influence. The government will be changed. We know the worth of your services. We esteem your friendship and aid so much that... Mellinger raises his hand, but the governor man bottles him up. Do not speak until I have done. The governor man then draws a package wrapped in paper from his pocket and lays it on the table by Mellinger's hand. In that you will find $100,000 in money of your country. You can do nothing against us, but you can be worth that for us. Go back to the capital and obey our instructions. Take that money now. We trust you. You will find with it a paper giving in detail the work you will be expected to do for us. Do not have the unwiseness to refuse. The governor man paused with his eyes fixed on Mellinger, full of expressions and observances. I looked at Mellinger and was glad Billy Renfro couldn't see him then. The sweat was popping out on his forehead, and he stood dumb, tapping the little package with the ends of his fingers. The Colorado Maduro gang was after his graft. He had only to change his politics and stuff six figures in his inside pocket. Henry whispers to me and wants the pause in the program interpreted. I whisper back, HP is up against a bribe, Senator sighs, and the coons have got him going. I saw Mellinger's hand moving closer to the package. He's weakening, I whispered to Henry. We'll remind him, says Henry, of the peanut roaster on 34th Street, New York. Henry stooped and got a record from the basketful we'd brought, slid it in the phonograph, and started her off. It was a cornet solo, very neat and beautiful, and the name of it was Home Sweet Home. Not one of them 50-odd men in the room moved while it was playing, and the governor man kept his eyes steady on Mellinger. I saw Mellinger's head go up little by little, and his hand came creeping away from the package. Not until the last note sounded did anybody stir. And then Homer P. Mellinger takes up the bundle of boodle and slams it in the governor man's face. That's my answer, says Mellinger, private secretary, and there'll be another in the morning. I have proofs of conspiracy against every man of you. The show is over, gentlemen. There's one more act, puts in the governor man. You are a servant, I believe, employed by the president to copy letters and answer raps at the door. I am governor here. Señores, I call upon you in the name of the cause to seize this man. That brindled gang of conspirators shoved back their chairs and advanced in force. I could see where Mellinger had made a mistake in massing his enemies so as to make the grandstand play. I think he made another one, too, but we can pass that, Mellinger's idea of a graft and mine being different, according to estimations and points of view. There was only one window and door in that room, and they were in the front end. Here was 50-odd Latin men coming in a bunch to obstruct the legislation of Mellinger. You may say there were three of us, for me and Henry, simultaneous, declared New York City and the Cherokee Nation in sympathy with the weaker party. Then it was that Henry Horsecollar rose to a point of disorder and intervened, showing, admirable, the advantages of education as applied to the American Indian's natural intellect and native refinement. He stood up and smoothed back his hair on each side with his hands as you have seen little girls do when they play. Get behind me, both of you, says Henry. What is it to be? I asked. I'm going to buck center, says Henry, in his football idioms. There isn't a tackle in the lot of 'em. Keep close behind me and rush the game. That cultured red man exhaled an arrangement of sounds with his mouth that caused the Latin aggregation to pause with thoughtfulness and hesitations. The matter of his proclamation seemed to be a cooperation of the Cherokee College yell with the Carlisle war whoop. He went at the chocolate team like the flip of a little boy's nigger shooter. His right elbow laid out the governor man on the gridiron, and he made a lane the length of the crowd that a woman could have carried a stepladder through without striking anything. All me and Mellinger had to do was follow. In 5 minutes we were out of that street and at the military headquarters where Mellinger had things his own way. The next day Mellinger takes me and Henry to one side and begins to shed tens and twenties. I want to buy that phonograph, he says. I like that last tune it played. Now you boys better go back home, for they'll give you trouble here before I get the screws put on them. If you happen to ever see Billy Renfro again, tell him I'm coming back to New York as soon as I can make a stake. Honest. This is more money, says I, than the machine is worth. 'Tis government expense money, says Mellinger, and the government's getting the tune grinder cheap. Henry and I knew that pretty well, but we never let Homer P. Mellinger know that we had seen how near he came to losing his graft. We laid low until the day the steamer came back. When we saw the captain's boat on the beach, me and Henry went down and stood in the edge of the water. The captain grinned when he saw us. "I told you you'd be waiting," he says. "Where's the hamburger machine?" "It stays behind," I says, "to play Home Sweet Home." "I told you so," says the captain again. "Climb in the boat." "And that," said Kirksey, "is the way me and Henry Horsecollar introduced the phonograph in that Latin country along about the vicinity of South America." And that story was The Phonograph and the Graft by O. Henry from Great Short Stories of the World, edited by Lois Hill. And now from The World's Shortest Stories, edited by Steve Moss. No words left. Alzheimer's was killing his father. He held the door at the restaurant as his father shuffled in for Sunday breakfast. An older gentleman inside helped, whispering, "You're a good boy," to the son. After his father died, he always remembered those words, knowing his father would have said them himself if he could have. And that was No Words Left by E. Carl Folk, Jr., from The World's Shortest Stories, edited by Steve Moss. And that's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On Demand Podcasts. You can listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.